Today, I want to kind of continue a bit the discussion from last time where we started to talk about some of the subtleties that come up when you might see overfitting when you're trying to find a model to represent your data. So I want to spend the first part of the lecture talking about something called the bias variance trade-off. Then we'll talk about some more ideas related to overfitting. So by the end of this lecture, you'll kind of understand what I mean by these different types of data sets, training, validation, and testing that we can divide our data into. And then overfitting is something we particularly have to worry about in neural networks. So we're going to talk about some methods that you can incorporate into your neural network algorithms that can help to prevent overfitting. And then if there's time, I want to revisit the idea that I think we kind of touched on quickly in lecture one of using supervised neural networks to learn about phases of matter. And specifically, we'll talk about kind of how you do this for the Ising model. The reason I want to just quickly revisit this in a little bit more detail than before is because it's going to be the problem that you work on in homework one. Okay, so this bias variance trade-off, it's a... I think it's something really interesting to be thinking about. A really good reference that talks about this is this machine learning review paper and section 3 of this paper. Of course, this is not the original reference, but I think it gives a really nice summary. So let me just remind you of the setup in supervised learning in general is that we have a data set that has pairs. So we often call X, you know, our data point, and then Y might be called our label. And so an unknown function is used to generate these labels, and we want to find a model that is a good approximation to the function that actually generated this data. And then in order to measure how well we're doing, we're going to use some kind of an error function to measure how much the model that we fit to differs from the actual labels that we expect. So we're going to talk about some concepts in terms of some kind of an error measure that's looking at the difference between what we get and what we would expect to get. And we saw last time that we don't want to just consider, at the end of last lecture, I kind of motivated that we don't want to only consider this error function for data that we've trained on, but we also want to consider how this error function behaves for data that we haven't trained on. So we want to consider how well our model can approximate data that it hasn't actually seen when it was determining the values of its parameters. So, of course, we still need to have some data to train our model to help us determine what the adjustable parameters in that model should be. So I'm going to call this the in-sample data and say that I'm going to call its error e_in. And then we'll also look at out-of-sample or generalization data. And this is going to let us study how well the model can make predictions. And in this case, the error is going to be, we'll just write that as E out. So, okay, one initial question. There's some relationship I can think of right away between these errors Is there anything that comes to mind when you think about them? For example, should do you think one of them is usually or always going to be bigger than the other one? Anything? Any thoughts about how those errors might be related? Yeah.
The insip one's probably small.
Yeah, the in one is always going to be smaller because we're training on this data, so we're minimizing this error explicitly in the training process. Yeah. And let me just note that we're going to assume that the data in the plots that I'm going to show you, we're assuming that the data is coming from a complicated underlying function to produce the data that we are not actually able to learn exactly. We can approximate it to better and better accuracy, but we're not going to be able to learn it exactly. Okay, so then, if I choose a model class that I'm going to fit to, and I have a large enough number of data points, I can study how these different errors behave as a function of a couple of different x-axes. So let's start by thinking about how my E in and E out are going to behave as a function of the number of data points that I have to use for my training. So I think it's good to kind of like take a second to think about this to try to build some intuition for what you think the behavior would be. So let me maybe just give you a few seconds to try to think about E in, for example, so the error that we're training on. How do you think this error will behave as a function of the number of data points that I use in my training? Or even if you don't have the full answer, just something you think you might have to consider. Yeah, so how does this E in, the error of the in samples that I train on, how is that going to, for a given model class that I fit to, how will that error behave as a function of the number of data points that I have? Yeah.
Well, if you have a fixed number of parameters,
yeah,
and like weights and things, it'll be exponentially down to some limit.
Right. So you would think that it's kind of better to have more data so that error should go down. So you're right in a sense, but that's actually the error of the out sample. So let's draw that one first because you... So as we have more data points, we would expect that the training data that we have is kind of a better approximation to our true distribution for our data. So the data of our out-of-sample, the error, sorry, of our out-of-sample data set is going to decrease, but actually the error in sample is going to increase as a function of the number of data points. And this is because if you have a smaller number of data points, you might actually be overfitting your data. So you'll have a low error, but as we saw last time, a low error on your in-sample data doesn't actually mean that you have a good prediction, even though you might say it's a good fit because it goes through all the data points, but it's not actually able to predict well data outside. And so we should actually see these two approach each other as we have infinite data. So let me kind of explain a little bit more. And actually, I'll leave this here and let me write over here. So why does this increase? The fact that this increases and converges to a finite value, it's really because our model is not good enough to represent our data in the assumptions that we're making. So since this model is not powerful enough, we wouldn't actually expect that this EN would go to zero because this model is just not good enough to represent everything we want to represent with this data. But as the number of data points increases, my data that I'm training on does become more representative of the true distribution. And so in the infinite data limit, I would expect that these two would approach each other, because what I'm training on is going to be very similar to what I'm generalizing to. So then there's a couple of words that, or terms that we can talk about that we can label actually on this plot. So the first is the bias, and this is a property of our model. So the bias is this value that we approach this error, we expect this error to approach in the infinite data limit. So again, this is a property of the model, and it's the it's how well this model can do in the limit of infinite data. So of course, we can make this bias go down if we have a better model that better represents our data. And usually that's going to mean a more complicated model. Okay, then there's another quantity we can talk about, which is the variance, and that's actually this one here. Okay, so the variance is, and in this paper they give explicit formulas that explain exactly what it is, but the idea is that it's measuring how dependent the fit is on the particular realization of your training data. So, of course, if I were to repeat this experiment many, many times, on average, I might get some of the right properties, but the fit that I'm getting might depend a lot on the particular realization that I train on if I only have a small number of data points. And so I think there are maybe some pitfalls to be aware of here. So I think a lot of times when you see this plot, you might think, okay, as long as I just train for a high enough number of data points, I can make this variance go away. So ultimately, what I want to do is just minimize the bias. But of course, we're often going to be in situations where we have a fixed number of data that we have access to. So we really have to be aware of both of these elements. So just to say that in a slightly different way, if we have a given amount of data, the actual best predictive power, so the best ability to generalize to situations beyond what we've trained on, is actually going to come from minimizing this out-of-sample error rather than just minimizing the bias and looking at a more complicated model. And one more thing that we've kind of said already is, of course, in some regimes of this plot, there's a big difference between the out-of-sample error and the in-sample error. This is kind of measuring the difference in the quality of your fit versus your predictions. And if this difference is large, similar to some of the cases we saw today, this is an indication of overfitting. If you're doing really well on your training data, but not so well on your generalization data. Are there any questions so far? Okay. So now let's consider another plot. I'm going to ask you to make predictions again. So now, let's vary the complexity of our model. We'll keep the number of data points fixed. So let's start by thinking about the bias parameter. Ultimately, we want to look at the performance of this output error because, as we saw, as I kind of argued here, that's kind of what we really want to look at to get the best predictive power for our data. So let me start by asking you about the bias. If we've argued that bias is just a property of how powerful the model is. So what would you expect to happen to the bias as you change the model complexity?
Probably go down and
yeah.
then saturate.
Yeah, perfect, yeah. So the bias is going to go down. And what about the variance?
Is it going to have a peak?
I think it's just going to increase. You're just going to be overfitting more and more. But there is something that's not just monotonic, and that's the actual output error, which, you know, it's a combination between these two. And that's actually going to behave like this. We see in our previous plot that it's affected by the bias plus the variance here. So it's actually going to behave like this. So that if I have a given data set, the optimum model is actually one with some intermediate complexity. So just a couple of quick notes here. So what this is really illustrating, the decreasing bias and increasing variance. This is really the bias variance trade-off. So it's tempting to just choose a more expressible, complicated model with lower bias, but this is going to correspond to an increased variance when you have a fixed data set. So, just repeating what I said, but I think it's a really kind of the whole takeaway, so I wanted to make sure I wrote it down, is that it's often tempting to choose just the most complicated model with the most parameters that you can because it'll have lower bias, but the best predictions will actually come in this situation from a model that has intermediate complexity. And to emphasize, if your model is not complex enough, you're going to have a very low variance with high bias. This is kind of the underfitting regime. Whereas as the variance gets very big but the bias gets low, this is the regime of overfitting. Any questions?
Why doesn't the minima of E out coincide with the...
Oh, I mean, it's really just adding these two curves together, and I think just... I didn't actually look at the actual way that these scale for an actual proper model class, but this is just the way that it was drawn in a paper. So I think it's, like, you really have to look at
I wanted to ask what the model complexity exactly.
Yeah.
I know it's the number of weights and biases and whatever number of layers, but how do you quantify exactly? What is it?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So you're right. It's I didn't really get into the subtleties of that, and I think, you know, if you're doing, for example, linear regression where you're just fitting to, or you're just fitting to a polynomial, of course it's pretty straightforward. It's just the number of coefficients. As I add one more coefficient, it gets slightly more complex. In a neural network, I think it's a lot more subtle to actually say what you mean by complexity. So, for example, if you go from having a single layer of a network with a given number of neurons, and then you go to a model that has two layers but the same number of neurons, is that more or less complex? So this is like a more complicated idea, and I think harder to define. But in this reference, they link some papers that actually get into how you would define that. But yeah, it's not so straightforward. I think we can kind of think of some cases where we can think of what more versus less complex means, but yeah, the definition is kind of subtle of exactly how you would set it up. Other questions? Okay, so now I want to get into more how we might see overfitting as we're training a model, because as we talked about with neural networks, you're not always guaranteed to be finding the solution that you want. You might get stuck along the way. The type of solution that you find might change as you continue training your models. So, let's talk about a few other ideas that come up in with overfitting. So, just because this is something we're going to plot in the tutorial this afternoon, let me just quickly say we're going to plot the accuracy of our predictions, and this just means the percentage of labels that we can get correct. Just another way of measuring performance. So, just as another way of kind of seeing overfitting in tutorial two. We're going to see cases where our cost function is decreasing, and we'll get actually even 100% accuracy on our training data, but we'll be able to tell by eye in what we see this afternoon that we're overfitting. And when I say decreasing, I mean as we train, so as a function of training time. Okay, so again, the algorithm that we've designed is minimizing cost. So you might see cases where this cost is going down, which is exactly what we've told the algorithm to minimize. And you might even see situations where the accuracy goes to one. But just as we talked about with the bias variance trade-off, if we're only looking at training accuracy, this is not going to be enough to actually know if this is a good choice of model. So to recognize overfitting, we're actually going to divide our data into three groups. And these are called testing, validation, sorry, training, validation, and testing. So the training data, this is what we've been kind of talking about all along. If I'm talking about the neural network, it's the data that I use to actually adjust the weights and biases. So the validation data is never used in the training procedure. But it can be used to diagnose overfitting. So what you might actually see is that your validation accuracy has a peak and then it might actually go down. So what can happen is that this will become low because my network is actually overfitting. So what you would actually want to do in this case is likely stop your training here. So this is, in many cases, going to be the best solution that I will find for this model. So this would be where I would want to stop and take the values of my parameters at this point rather than continuing to train. And again, of course, this training is with a given choice of hyperparameters for our network. So we could then adjust the hyperparameters and train again. And phrasing it this way, our goal would be to maximize this validation accuracy. Okay, so if I continue doing this for different hyperparameters and I look at this accuracy, I choose the case where that's as high as possible, that sounds like we're definitely doing something to prevent overfitting. Does anyone see any problem that pops up in doing this? I don't know if maybe I'm saying that kind of vaguely. So there's actually another kind of overfitting present in this procedure. Does anyone see it?
You mean because we're specifically fitting to the validation data?
Yeah, so you're choosing the hyperparameters to represent the validation data, so you could actually be overfitting your hyperparameters in doing this. So for this reason, you shouldn't actually say at the end of this procedure, if the best validation accuracy you get is 98%, you shouldn't actually say that that's really the accuracy of this model. What you should really do is look at a third data set to report the overall accuracy. And this is our testing data. So this data is never used to adjust the weights and biases, and it's also never used to adjust the hyperparameters. Okay, so since overfitting can be a particularly relevant problem in neural networks, let's talk about some ways we can actually try to prevent it by adjusting the algorithms that we use. So this is not a full list, but I'm going to tell you about two things that you could consider doing. The first one is that you could incorporate something called regularization. So you add an extra term to the cost function that depends on the weights. So we'll take the cost function that we already had, but we're gonna add another term that is some kind of a sum over weights. I might just take the sum of the magnitudes or take the sum squared. In doing so, I do introduce a new hyperparameter. So what this does really is that it prevents the neural network from just putting all of the weight into just one link that might only represent the training data that I have. It makes it spread these weights out more throughout the network. So the effect is that your neural network is gonna favor smaller weights. Now, if this parameter is too large, you're going to, too small. You're still gonna have overfitting. And if it's too large, you can have underfitting, because you won't actually be considering the data anymore. You'll just be choosing parameters based on whether the weights are small. So you won't be considering the actual features of your data enough. Questions about that? Okay, so one more thing to say is another method you can incorporate into neural networks called dropout. So the idea is that we mask out some of the hidden neurons. So the way I draw this, this might be my original neural network. I'm gonna temporarily, during the training, mask out some of these neurons in the hidden layer. So let me explain what I mean. You're gonna run some training steps for this new network that has some of the previous neurons masked out. So I would do some kind of a random masking, of course not for the whole training, because then I would just be choosing a simpler network. But I'll continue to choose different random maskings throughout the training. So the idea here is that it's kind of similar to averaging over many networks. I'm going to make sure that any of these chosen networks are going to do a good job of fitting the data, rather than, again, just relying on one neuron to do all the work. And of course, there's hyperparameters that come in here too, because you get to choose, you know, how many neurons you want to mask out in each layer. Okay, any questions at all about overfitting? Okay, so now for the last 10 minutes, I just want to revisit again a problem that we want to look at in homework one, which is how we can use supervised neural networks in order to help us study phases of matter in the same stuff. So I mentioned this paper before, but there's a paper by Juan Carrasquilla and Roger Malko from 2016, which studied this and kind of started to build a lot of excitement about using these neural networks within field of quantum matter. And they've also been major contributors to the content of this course. We've worked on that together. And so as part of homework one, you're going to reproduce some results from their paper. And we're going to start by talking about the Ising model. But then next lecture, we're going to also talk about a model with a more complicated kind of topological order and study algorithms that will be able to distinguish phases of matter in this case and a more complicated type of order. So just to remind you, the Ising model is a sum over nearest neighbors, and I have some spin variables that are discrete. So I'm going to store these spin variables as plus or minus one. You might think of them as up or down spins. So these spin degrees of freedom, they live on the sides of a lattice. We can consider many different lattices in many different dimensions, but specifically, let's just look at a two-dimensional square lattice. On a 2D square lattice, I'm just going to have a bunch of arrows pointing up or down. Okay, and in order to store this data, I just need to choose a way to label this graph. So, for example, I might choose to go along the bottom and then go upwards and label these spins, in this case. So, go from left to right until I reach the edge and then go up to the next row. And that's kind of how I'm going to store this. So let me also just remind you that for this 2D square lattice, if I go to the thermodynamic limit, I'm going to have a phase transition. So, and specifically at low temperatures, I have a ferromagnetic phase, and when I raise the temperature, I transition to a paramagnetic phase. And we know from theory what this phase transition is. And we also know from theory that there is an order parameter, which is the magnetization. And so the way that this magnetization looks, if I plot it as a function of temperature, is that it has some finite value at low temperatures, and then beyond some critical temperature, it's just zero. So I have a non-zero magnetization for the ferromagnetic phase, and I have zero magnetization for the paramagnetic phase. So we already know everything we could ever want to know about this two-dimensional icing model, but what we're going to see in homework one is we're going to answer the question of whether a neural network can learn some of those properties that we know to be true. So we're not going to tell it that there's a magnetization that it can use to help in its classification, and we're going to see if the neural network can do this classification procedure. So we want to see if a neural network can learn these ferromagnetic and paramagnetic phases as input. We're only going to give the spin configurations. So again, we're not going to tell it how to calculate magnetization. So my input is just going to be a vector based on how I've labeled this lattice. So for that example, I'm going to have as input like this, which corresponds to my spins on my lattice. My labels are just going to be 0 and 1 for ferromagnetic and paramagnetic. So on homework 1, I'm going to give you a data set containing these spin configurations. The data set will have been generated from a Monte Carlo simulation. I'll tell you just a little bit about Monte Carlo, just so you have an idea of where that data set comes from. But you don't really need to know about Monte Carlo for the homework. You just need to know that this data set represents the two-dimensional icing model, and then you're going to try to learn this, these labels. And next class, we're also going to explore some considerations we might have to have and the setup we would have for a different model with a topological kind of order, and then we'll continue to develop methods for studying other kinds of phases of matter throughout the course. Okay, so see you this afternoon for a tutorial which is going to give you some of the code that you'll need to do this homework assignment.
The Monte Carlo simulations that you used to make the configurations, did you start from a random distribution and then ran it for a long time, or did you start from like mostly positive and mostly negative, for ferromagnetic case, I mean, and you let it reach the equilibrium?
Yeah, you have to make sure you reach equilibrium,
right,
for sure, yeah.
Did you start from a random initial condition and then let it evolve, or Do you start from like mostly positive and mostly negative?
I always start my simulations from just a random state, and then you let them evolve based on the temperature. You can also like kind of start random kind of corresponds to infinite temperature, so you could also like start at infinite, start random and generate your configurations for a very high temperature and then take a step down in temperature and let it equilibrate. The equilibration time will be a bit lower because you're already kind of equilibrated for a slightly higher temperature. So there's like several strategies, but you can also just, yeah, start from random and then, yeah, but you do have to have ways of making sure that you're equilibrated before you actually start recording data, for sure.
So you did this for a 1D Ising model. Are you doing this for 1D or is this a 2D?
We're going to do this for 2D because then you have a phase transition at finite temperature.
Okay, so then how long did it take for, let's say for a particular temperature?
That's a good question. So I have to remember because I can't even remember which sizes of lattice I'm going to give you for this. Because that's a big factor, right? Like if it's a pretty small lattice. I can look into that timing and try to give you that information. If you're interested because you want to know how long it takes to run these.
I just want to know exactly how you ran the simulation. And you probably use Metropolis algorithm?
To generate, if you use only Metropolis, it's not going to be a very good data set because there's going to be correlations between the data points. So the actual data set that I'm going to give you uses some cluster updates as well to help reduce correlations. And it doesn't just give you, yeah, so this is getting a bit technical for people that haven't read about Monte Carlo, so don't worry. So if you just take two adjacent data points, they're going to have big correlations. So you also have to ensure that you space apart your data samples by a signal.
But you still did that with Metropolis algorithm? So you did like...
Well, I use a combination of Metropolis and cluster updates.
Oh.
It's both, yeah.
You remember how long it took for that to...
Yeah, I just can't remember for the homework which lattice sizes I'm going to give you and exactly how long it took. The data I'm going to give you, I generated a while ago and I probably ran it on a cluster, so I didn't really think so much about like how long it was running. But like I'll answer you next class and I'll like look into that. Yeah. In order to get actually data that's good with this effect of no correlation... I just can't remember the properties of the data set, so I'll answer you next time. Other questions? I would guess it was on the order of hours, like to get the data set that I'm going to give you. But
so the critical temperature 2.269, are we going to see a number that is within three decimal places is accurate, or we're going to see like 2.27 or 2.3.
Yeah, you'll see. I think what we're going to do is we're actually going to train on configurations generated at like discrete temperatures. I think it might be like 5 below the critical temperature and 5 above. So I don't think you're going to get it to 3 decimal places probably, but you're going to see. But that doesn't mean that you couldn't push the boundary with these methods, but when what I'm asking you to do, I don't think we're going to get it to that level of precision.
Did Kwan and Rogers see 2.269, or did they see like 2.27, I should probably look at the paper.
Yeah, so, I'm trying to remember exactly what they extracted in the end. So they looked at the... It's a subtle question because when you're on a finite lattice, you also don't see the temperature, the change in phase at exactly this point. You have to do finite size scaling as well. So I actually, now I need to look back at the paper to remember if they actually extract an estimate of this. Because more what we're going to do in the homework is, sorry, I'll be done. Yeah, we should finish. But what we're going to do in the homework is look at cases where we train on labels that we know and labels that we don't know and see if we can train it to learn the correct label. So if we can see that it will learn that if the temperature is less than TC, I'm going to learn to predict ferromagnetic. But I don't think the goal of the paper was to actually extract TC. I just can't remember if they did it in an appendix. They might have.
They might not have. I haven't read this one. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, but just to say, that's not the goal of the setup that we're doing.
Yeah, but one of Roger's students wrote another paper that was about finding that T equal to TC and.
Yeah, I'm sure, yeah. Anyway, let's, we can, maybe we can continue discussing at the tutorial this afternoon.